Both were gawking at the boy, as if he were a two-headed goat in a road show. I took the keys. Good. Now, back to the office, both of you.
Seems like you might be throwing your weight around a little, youngster, Black Hat said, and the other, a little man with an undershot jaw, nodded vigorously.
Go now, I said. This boy needs rest. They looked me up and down, then went, which was the correct thing. The only thing, really. My mood was not good. The boy kept his eyes covered until their boot heels faded back through the arch. Then he lowered his hands.
Will you catch him, Si?
Yes.
And will you kill him?
Does thee want me to kill him?
He considered this and nodded. Aye, for what he did to my da, and to Si Jefferson, and all the others, even Elrod.
I closed the door of the cell, found the right key, and turned it. The key ring I hung over my wrist, for it was too big for my pocket.
I'll make you a promise, young Bill, I said, one I swear to on my father's name. I won't kill him, but you shall be there when he swings, and with my own hand I'll give you the bread to scatter beneath his dead feet.
In the office, the two not-so-good deputies eyed me with caution and dislike, and that was nothing to me. I hung the key ring on the peg next to the jing-jang and said, I'll be back in an hour, maybe less. In the meantime, no one goes into the jail, and that includes you two.
High-handed for a shaveling, the one with the undershot jaw remarked.
Don't fail me in this, I said. It wouldn't be wise. Do you understand?
Black Hat nodded.
But the sheriff will hear how you've done with us.
Then you'll want to have a mouth still capable of speech when he gets back, I said, and went out. The wind had continued to strengthen, blowing clouds of gritty, salt-flavored dust between the false-fronted buildings. I had Debaria High Street entirely to myself, except for a few hitched horses that stood with their hindquarters turned to the wind and their heads unhappily lowered. I would not leave my own so, nor Millie, the mule the boy had ridden, and led them down to the livery stable at the far end of the street. There the hostler was glad to take them, especially when I split him off half a gold nut from the bundle I carried in my vest. No, he said in answer to my first question, there was no jeweler in Debaria, nor ever had been in his time. But the answer to my second question was Yar, and he pointed across the street to the blacksmith's shop. The smith himself was standing in the doorway, the hem of his tool-filled leather apron flapping in the wind. I walked across, and he put his fist to his forehead.
Heil!
I heiled him in return and told him what I wanted, what Vinay had said I might need. He listened closely, then took the shell I handed him. It was the very one I'd used to entrance young Bill. The blackie held it up to the light.
How many grains of powder does it blow, can he say?
Of course I could. 57.
As many as that? Gods, it's a wonder the barrel of your revolver don't bust when he pull the trigger.
The shells in my father's guns, the ones I might someday carry, blew 76, but I didn't say so. He'd likely not have believed it. Can you do what I ask, Si?
I think so.
He considered, then nodded.
Aye, but not today. I don't like to run my smith hold hot in the wind. One loose ember in the whole town might catch a blaze. We've had no fire department since my da was a boy.
I took out my bag of gold knuckles and shook two into the palm of my hand. I considered, then added a third. The smith stared at them with wonder. He was looking at 2 years' wages. It has to be today, I said. He grinned, showing teeth of amazing whiteness within the forest of his ginger beard.
Tempting devil, get not aside. For what you're showing me, I'd risk burning Gilead herself to her foundations. You'll have it by sundown.
I'll have it by 3.
Aye, 3's what I meant, to the shaved point of the minute.
Good. Now tell me, which restaurant cooks the best chow in town?
There's only 2, and neither of 'em will make you remember your mother's bird puddin', but neither'll poison 'ee. Racy's Cafe is probably the better.
That was good enough for me. I thought a growing boy like Bill Streeter would take quantity over quality any day.
I headed for the cafe, now working against the wind. It'll be a full-going simoom by dark, the boy had told me, and I thought he was right. He had been through a lot and needed time to rest. Now that I knew about the ankle tattoo, I might not need him at all, but the skin man wouldn't know that. And in the jail, young Bill was safe. At least, I hoped so. It was stew, and I could have sworn it had been seasoned with alkali grit instead of salt, but the kid ate all of his and finished mine as well when I put it aside. One of the not-so-good deputies had made coffee, and we drank that from tin cups. We made our meal right there in the cell, sitting cross-legged on the floor. I listened for the jing-jang, but it stayed quiet. I wasn't surprised. Even if Jamie and the high sheriff came near one at their end, the wind had probably taken the wires down. "I guess you know all about these storms you call simooms," I said to young Bill. "Oh, yes," he said. "This is the season for 'em. The proddies hate 'em, and the pokies hate 'em even more, because if they're out on the range, they have to sleep rough, and they can't have a fire at night, of course, because of the embers," I said, remembering the blacksmith. "Just as you say, stew's all gone, is it?" "So it is, but there's one more thing." I handed over a little sack. He looked inside it and lit up. "Candy! Rollers and chocotwists!" He extended the bag. "Here, you have the first." I took one of the little chocolate twists, then pushed the bag back to him. "You have the rest, if it won't make your belly sick, that is." "It won't." And he dived in. It did me good to see him. After the third roller went into his gob, he cheeked it, which made him look like a squirrel with a nut, and said, "What'll happen to me, Si, now that my da's gone?" "I don't know, but there'll be water if God wills it." I already had an idea where that water might be. If we could put paid to the skin man, a certain large lady named Everlyn would owe us a good turn, and I doubt if Bill Streeter would be the first stray she'd taken in. I returned to the subject of the simoom. "How much will it strengthen?" "It'll blow a gale tonight, probably after midnight, and by noon tomorrow it'll be gone." "Does thee know where the salties live?" "Aye, I've even been there, once with my da to see the races they sometimes have up there, and once with some proddies looking for strays. The salties take 'em in, and we pay with hard biscuit for the ones that have the Jefferson brand." "My trail mate's gone there with Sheriff Peavy and a couple of others. Think they'll have any chance of getting back before nightfall?" I felt sure he would say no, but he surprised me. Being as it's all downhill from Salt Village, which is on this side of Little Debaria, I'd say they could, if they rode hard. That made me glad I'd told the blacksmith to hurry, although I knew better than to trust the reckoning of a mere boy. "Listen to me, young Bill. When they come back, I expect they'll have some of the salties with them, maybe a dozen, maybe as many as 20. Jamie and I may have to walk 'em through the jail for you to look at, but you needn't be afraid, because the door of this cell will be locked, and you don't have to say anything. Just look. If you're thinking I can tell which one killed my da, I can't. I don't even remember if I saw him." "You probably won't have to see them at all," I said. This I truly believed. We'd have them into the sheriff's office by threes and have them hike their pants. When we found the one with the blue ring tattooed around his ankle, we'd have our man. Not that he was a man. Not anymore. Not really. "Would you like another chalker, Si? There's three left, and I can't eat no more." "Save them for later," I said, and got up. His face clouded. "Will you come back? I don't want to be in here on my own." "I'll come back." I stepped out, locked the cell door, then tossed the keys to him through the bars. "Let me in when I do." The fat deputy with the black hat was Strother. The one with the undershot jaw was Pickens. They looked at me with care and mistrust, which I thought a good combination coming from the likes of them. I could work with care and mistrust. "If I asked you fellows about a man with a blue ring tattooed on his ankle, would it mean anything to you?" They exchanged a glance, and then Black Hat, Strother, said, "The stockade." "What stockade would that be?" Already, I didn't like the sound of it.
Beely stockade, Pickens said, looking at me as though I were the utterest of utter idiots. Does thee not know of it, and thee a gunslinger?
Beely town's west of here, isn't it? I asked.
Was, Strother said. It's Beely ghost town now. Harriers tore through it 5 years ago. Some say John Farson's men, but I don't believe that, never in life. 'Twas plain old garden-variety outlaws. Once there was a militia outpost, back in the days when there was a militia, and Beely stockade was their place of business. It was where the circuit judge sent thieves and murderers and card cheats.
Witches and warlocks, too, Pickens volunteered.
He wore the face of a man remembering the good old days, when the railroad trains ran on time and the jing-jang no doubt rang more often, with calls from more places.
Practicers of the dark arts.
Once they took a cannibal, Strother said. He ate his wife.
This caused him to give out with a foolish giggle, although whether it was the eating or the relationship that struck him as funny, I couldn't say.
He was hung, that fellow, Pickens said.
He bit off a chunk of chew and worked it with his peculiar jaw. He still looked like a man remembering a better, rosier past.
There was lots of hangings at Beely Stockade in those days. I went several times with my da and my mamar to see him. Mamar always packed a lunch.
He nodded slowly and thoughtfully.
Aye, many and many a. Lots of folks came. There was booths and clever people doing clever things such as juggling. Sometimes there was dogfights in a pit, but of course it was the hangings that were the real show.
He chuckled.
I remember this one fella who kicked a regular Kamala when the drop didn't break his...
What's this to do with blue ankle tattoos?
Oh, Strother said, recalled to the initial subject. Anyone who ever did time in Beely had one of those put on, you see. Although I disremember if it was for punishment or just identification in case they ran off from one of the work gangs. All that stopped 10 years ago when the stockade closed. That's why the Harriers was able to have their way with the town, you know. Because the militia left and the stockade closed. Now we have to deal with all the bad element and riffraff ourselves.
He eyed me up and down in the most insolent way.
We don't get much help from Gilead these days. Nope. Have to get more from John Farson. And there's some that'd send a parley party west to ask him.
Perhaps he saw something in my eyes, because he sat up a little straighter in his chair and said,
"Not me, of course. Never. I believe in the straight law and the line of eld."
"So do we all," Pickens said, nodding vigorously.
"Would you want to guess if some of the salt miners did time in Beely Stockade before it was decommissioned?" I asked. Strother appeared to consider, then said,
"Oh, probably a few. No more than 4 in every 10, I should say."
In later years, I learned to control my face, but those were early times, and he must have seen my dismay. It made him smile. I doubt if he knew how close that smile brought him to suffering. I'd had a difficult 2 days, and the boy weighed heavily on my mind.
Who did he think would take a job digging salt blocks out of a miserable hole in the ground for penny wages? Strother asked. Model citizens?
It seemed that young Bill would have to look at a few of the salties after all. We'd just have to hope the fellow we wanted didn't know the ring tattoo was the only part of him the kid had seen. When I went back to the cell, young Bill was lying on the pallets, and I thought he'd gone to sleep. But at the sound of my boot heels, he sat up. His eyes were red, his cheeks wet. Not sleeping then, but mourning. I let myself in, sat down beside him, and put an arm around his shoulders. This didn't come naturally to me. I know what comfort and sympathy are, but I've never been much good at giving such. I knew what it was to lose a parent, though. Young Bill and young Roland had that much in common.
"Did you finish your candy?" I asked.
"Don't want the rest," he said, and sighed. Outside, the wind boomed hard enough to shake the building, then subsided.
"I hate that sound," he said, just what Jamie DeCurry had said. It made me smile a little. and I hate being in here. It's like I did something wrong.
You didn't, I said.
Maybe not, but it already seems like I've been here forever, cooped up. And if they don't get back before nightfall, I'll have to stay longer, won't I?
I'll keep you company, I said. If those deputies have a deck of cards, we can play Jack's pop-up.
For babies, he said morosely.
Then watch me, or poker. Can thee play those?
He shook his head, then brushed at his cheeks. The tears were flowing again.
I'll teach thee. We'll play for matchsticks.
I'd rather hear the story you talked about when we stopped in the Sheppy's lay-by. I don't remember the name.
The wind through the keyhole, I said.
But it's a long one, Bill.
We have time, don't we?
I couldn't argue that.
There are scary bits in it, too. Those things are all right for a boy such as I was, sitting up in his bed with his mother beside him. But after what you've been through...
Don't care, he said. Stories take a person away. If they're good ones, that is. Is it a good one?
Yes, I always thought so anyway.
Then tell it.
He smiled a little. I'll even let you have two of the last three chalkers.
Those are yours, but I might roll a smoke.
I thought about how to begin.
Do you know stories that start once upon a by before your grandfather's grandfather was born?
They all start that way, at least the ones my da told me, before he said I was too old for stories.
A person's never too old for stories, Bill. Man and boy, girl and woman, never too old. We live for them.
Do you say so?
I do.
I took out my tobacco and papers. I rolled slowly, for in those days it was a skill yet new to me. When I had a smoke just to my liking, one with the draw end tapered to a pinhole, I struck a match on the wall. Bill sat cross-legged on the straw pallets. He took one of the chalkers, rolled it between his fingers much as I'd rolled my smoke, then tucked it into his cheek. I started slowly and awkwardly, because storytelling was another thing that didn't come naturally to me in those days, although it was a thing I learned to do well in time. I had to. All gunslingers have to. And as I went along, I began to speak more naturally and easily, because I began hearing my mother's voice. It began to speak through my own mouth, every rise, dip, and pause. I could see him fall into the tale, and that pleased me. It was like hypnotizing him again, but in a better way, a more honest way. The best part, though, was hearing my mother's voice. It was like having her again, coming out from far inside me. It hurt, of course, but more often than not, the best things do, I found. You wouldn't think it could be so, but, as the old-timers used to say, the world's tilted, and there's an end to it. Once upon a by, before your grandfather's grandfather was born, on the edge of an unexplored wilderness called the Endless Forest, there lived a boy named Tim with his mother, Nell, and his father, Big Ross. For a time, the three of them lived happily enough, although they owned little. The Wind Through the Keyhole. Once upon a by, long before your grandfather's grandfather was born, on the edge of an unexplored wilderness called the Endless Forest, there lived a boy named Tim with his mother Nell and his father Big Ross. For a time, the three of them lived happily enough, although they owned little.
I have only four things to pass on to you, Big Ross told his son, but four's enough.
Can you say them to me, young boy?
Tim had said them to him many and many a, but never tired of it. Thy axe, thy lucky coin, thy plot, and thy place, which is as good as the place of any king or gunslinger in Midworld. He would then pause and add, my mama, too. That makes five. Big Ross would laugh and kiss the boy's brow as he lay in his bed, for this catechism usually came at the end of the day. Behind them, in the doorway, Nell waited to put her kiss on top of her husband's.
"Aye," Big Ross would say, "we must never forget Mama, for without her all's for naught."
So Tim would go off to sleep, knowing he was loved, and knowing he had a place in the world, and listening to the night wind slip its strange breath over the cottage, sweet with the scent of blossy wood at the edge of the endless forest, and faintly sour, but still pleasant, with the smell of the ironwood trees deeper in, where only brave men dared go. Those were good years, but as we know, from stories and from life, the good years never last long. One day, when Tim was 11, Big Ross and his partner, Big Kells, drove their wagons down Main Road to where the Ironwood Trail entered the forest, as they did every morning save the 7th, when all in the village of Tree rested. On this day, however, only Big Kells came back. His skin was sooty and his jerkin charred. There was a hole in the left leg of his homespun pants. Red and blistered flesh peeped through it. He slumped on the seat of his wagon, as if too weary to sit up straight. Nell Ross came to the door of her house and cried, "Where is Big Ross? Where is my husband?" Big Kells shook his head slowly from side to side. Ash sifted out of his hair and onto his shoulders. He spoke only a single word, but one was enough to turn Tim's knees to water. His mother began to shriek. The word was dragon. No one living today has ever seen the like of the endless forest, for the world has moved on. It was dark and full of dangers. The woodsmen of Tree Village knew it better than anyone in Midworld, and even they knew nothing of what might live or grow 10 wheels beyond the place where the blossy groves ended and the ironwood trees, those tall, brooding sentinels, began. The great depths were a mystery filled with strange plants, stranger animals, stinking weird marshes, and, so 'twas said, leavings of the old people that were often deadly. The folken of Tree feared the endless forest, and rightly so. Big Ross wasn't the first woodsman who went down the Ironwood Trail and did not come back. Yet they loved it, too, for 'twas ironwood fed and clothed their families. They understood, though none would have said so aloud, that the forest was alive, and, like all living things, it needed to eat. Imagine that you were a bird flying above that great tract of wildland. From up there it might look like a giant dress of a green so dark it was almost black. Along the bottom of the dress was a hem of lighter green. These were the blossywood groves. Just below the Blossies, at the farthest edge of Northard Barony, was the village of Tree. It was the last town in what was then a civilized country. Once Tim asked his father what civilized meant. "Taxes," Big Ross said, and laughed, but not in a funny way. Most of the woodsmen went no farther than the Blossy Groves. Even there, sudden dangers could arise. Snakes were the worst, but there were also poisonous rodents called wervels that were the size of dogs. Many men had been lost in the Blossies over the years, but on the whole, Blossy was worth the risk. It was a lovely, fine-grained wood, golden in color and almost light enough to float on air. It made fine lake and river craft, but was no good for sea travel. Even a moderate gale would tear apart a boat made of Blossy. For sea travel, ironwood was wanted, and ironwood brought a high price from Hodiak, the barony buyer who came twice a year to the Tree sawmill. It was ironwood that gave the endless forest its green-black hue, and only the bravest woodsmen dared go after it, for there were dangers along the ironwood trail, which barely pierced the skin of the endless forest, remember, that made the snakes, wervels, and muty bees of the Blossy Grove seem mild by comparison. Dragons, for instance. So it was that in his 11th year, Tim Ross lost his dough. Now there was no axe and no lucky coin hanging around Big Ross's burly neck on its fine silver chain. Soon there might be no plot in the village or place in the world either. For in those days, when the time of wide earth came around, the Barony Covenanter came with it. He carried a scroll of parchment paper, and the name of every family and tree was writ upon it, along with a number. That number was the amount of tax. If you could pay it, 4 or 6 or 8 silver nucks, even a gold one for the largest of the freeholds, all was well. If you couldn't, the barony took your plot, and you were turned out on the land. There was no appeal. Tim went half days to the cottage of the widow Smack, who kept school and was paid in food, usually vegetables, sometimes a bit of meat. Long ago, before the blood sores had come on her and eaten off half her face, so the children whispered, although none had actually seen it, she had been a great lady in the barony estates far away, or so the children's elders claimed, although none actually knew. Now she wore a veil and taught likely lads, even a few lassies, how to read and practice the slightly questionable art known as mathematica. She was a fearsomely smart woman who took no guff, and most days she was tireless. Her pupils usually came to love her in spite of her veil and the horrors they imagined might lie beneath it. But on occasion she would begin to tremble all over and cry that her poor head was splitting and that she must lie down. On these days she would send the children home, sometimes commanding them to tell their parents that she regretted nothing, least of all, her beautiful prince. Cy Smack had one of her fugues about a month after the dragon burned Big Ross to ashes, and when Tim came back to his cottage, which was called Goodview, he looked in the kitchen window and saw his mother crying with her head on the table. He dropped the slate with his mathematica problems on it, long division, which he had feared but turned out to be only backwards multiplication, and rushed to her side. She looked up at him and tried to smile. The contrast between her upturned lips and her streaming eyes made Tim feel like crying himself. It was the look of a woman at the end of her tether. "What is it, Mama? What's wrong?" "Just thinking of your father. Sometimes I miss him so. Why are you home early?" He began to tell her, but stopped when he saw the leather purse with the drawstring top. She had put one of her arms over it, as if to hide it from him, and when she saw him looking, she swept it off the table and into her lap. Now, Tim was far from a stupid boy, so he made tea before saying anything else. When she had drunk some, with sugar, which he insisted she take, although there was little enough left in the pot, and had calmed, he asked her what else was wrong. "I don't know what you mean." "Why were you counting our money?" "What little there is to count," said she. "Covenant man will be here once reaptide's gone. Aye, while the embers of the bonfire are still hot, if I know his ways. And what then?" "He'll want 6 silver knuckles this year, perhaps as many as 8, for taxes have gone up, so they do say. Probably another of their stupid wars somewhere far from here. Soldiers with their banners flying, aye, very fine." "How much do we have?" 4, and a scrap of a 5th. "We have no livestock to sell, nor a single round of ironwood since your father died. What shall we do?" She began to cry again. "What shall we do?" Tim was as frightened as she was, but since there was no man to comfort her, he held his own tears back and put his arms around her and soothed her as best he could. "If we had his axe and his coin, I'd sell them to Destry," she said at last. Tim was horrified, even though the axe and lucky coin were gone, burned in the same fiery blast that had taken their cheerful, good-hearted owner. "You never would." "Aye, to keep his pot in his place, I would. Those were the things he truly cared about, and thee and me. Could he speak, he'd say, "Do it, Nell, and welcome, for Destry has hard coin." She sighed. But then would come old Barony Covenant Man next year, and the year after that? She put her hands over her face. "Oh, Tim, we shall be turned out on the land, and there's not one thing I can think to change it. Can you?" Tim would have given everything he owned, which was very little, to be able to give her an answer, but he could not. He could only ask how long it would be before the Covenant Man would appear in Tree on his tall black horse, sitting astride a saddle worth more than Big Ross had made in 25 years of risking his life on that narrow track known as the Ironwood Trail. She held up 4 fingers. "This many weeks, if the weather is fair." She held up 4 more. "This many, if it's foul, and he's held up in the farming villages of the Middles. 8 is the most we can hope for, I think. And then..." "Something will happen before he comes," Tim said. "Da always said that the forest gives to them that love it." "All I've ever seen it do is take," said Nell, and covered her face again. When he tried to put an arm around her, she shook her head. Tim trudged out to get his slate. He had never felt so sad and frightened. "Something will happen to change it," he thought. "Please let something happen to change it." The worst thing about wishes is that sometimes they come true. That was a rich, full earth in Tree. Even Nell knew it, although the ripe land was bitter in her eye. The following year, she and Tim might be following the crops, with burlap rucksacks on their backs, farther and farther from the endless forest, and that made summer's beauty hard to look at. The forest was a terrible place, and it had taken her man, but it was the only place she had ever known. At night, when the wind blew from the north, it stole to her bed through her open window like a lover, bringing its own special smell, one both bitter and sweet, like blood and strawberries. Sometimes when she slept, she dreamed of its deep tilts and secret corridors, and of sunshine so diffuse that it glowed like old green brass. "The smell of the forest when the wind's out of the north brings visions," the old folkin said. Nell didn't know if this was true or just chimney-corner blather, but she knew the smell of the endless forest was the smell of life as well as death. And she knew that Tim loved it, as his father had, as she herself had, although often against her will. She had secretly feared the day when the boy would grow tall enough and strong enough to go down that dangerous trail with his da, but now she found herself sorry that day would never come. Cy Smack and her Mathematica were all very well, but Nell knew what her son truly wanted, and she hated the dragon that had stolen it from him. Probably it had been a she-dragon and only protecting her egg, but Nell hated it just the same. She hoped the plated, yellow-eyed bitch would swallow her own fire, as the old stories said they sometimes did, and explode. One day, not so many after Tim had arrived home early and found her in tears, Big Kells came calling on Nell. Tim had gotten 2 weeks' work helping Farmer Destry with the hay cutting, so she was by her onesome in the garden, weeding on her knees. When she saw her late husband's friend and partner, she got to her feet and wiped her dirty hands on the burlap apron she called her wedekin. A single look at his clean hands and carefully trimmed beard was enough to tell her why he'd come. Once upon a by, Nell Robertson, Jack Ross, and Byrne Kells had been children together and great pals. Littermates from different litters, people of the village sometimes said when they saw the three of them together. In those days, they were inseparable. When they grew to young manhood, both boys fancied her, and while she loved them both, it was Big Ross she burned for. Big Ross she'd wed and taken to bed, although whether that was the order of it, no one knew, nor really cared. Big Kells had taken it as well as any man can. He stood beside Ross at the wedding and slipped the silk around them for their walk back down the aisle when the preacher was done. When Kells took it off them at the door, although it never really comes off, so they do say, he kissed them both and wished them a lifetime of long days and pleasant nights. Although the afternoon Kells came to her in the garden was hot, he was wearing a broadcloth jacket. From the pocket, he took a loosely knotted length of silk rope, as she knew he would. A woman knows. Even if she's long married, a woman knows, and Kells's heart had never changed. "Will he?" he asked. "If he will, I'll sell my place to old Destry. He wants it, for it sits next to his east field, and keep this one. Covenant man's coming, Nellie, and he'll have his hand out. With no man, how'll he fill it?"
"I cannot, as thee knows," said she.
"Then tell me, shall we slip the rope?"
She wiped her hands nervously on her wedekin, although they were already as clean as they'd be without water from the creek.
I need to think about it."
"What's to think about?"
He took his bandana, neatly folded in his pocket instead of tied loosely, woodsman style, around his neck, and mopped his forehead with it.
"Either he do, and we go on and tree as we always have. I'll find the boy something to work at that'll bring in a little, although he's far too wee for the woods. Or ye and he'll go on the land.
I can share, but I can't give, much as I might like to. I have only one place to sell, Kennet."
She thought, "He's trying to buy me to fill the empty side of the bed that Millicent left behind." But that seemed an unworthy thought for a man she'd known long before he was a man, and one who had worked for years by her beloved husband's side in the dark and dangerous trees near the end of the Ironwood Trail.
"One to watch and one to work," the old-timer said, "pull together and never apart."
Now that Jack Ross was gone, Byrne Kells was asking her to pull with him. It was natural. Yet she hesitated.
"Come tomorrow at this same time, if you still have a mind," Nell told him. "I'll give thee an answer then."
He didn't like it. She saw he didn't like it. She saw something in his eyes that she had occasionally glimpsed when she had been a green girl sparked by two likely lads in the envy of all her friends. That look was what caused her to hesitate, even though he had appeared like an angel offering her, and Tim, of course, a way out of the terrible dilemma that had come with Big Ross's death. Perhaps he saw her seeing it, for he dropped his gaze. He studied his feet for a bit, and when he looked up again, he was smiling. It made him almost as handsome as he had been as a youth, but never so handsome as Jack Ross.
"Tomorrow, then, but no longer. They have a saying in the Westerns, my dear. Look not long at what's offered, for every precious thing has wings and may fly away."
She washed at the edge of the creek, stood smelling the sweet, sour aroma of the forest for a bit, then went inside and lay down upon her bed. It was unheard of for Nell Ross to be horizontal while the sun was still in the sky, but she had much to think of and much to remember from those days when two young woodsmen had vied for her kisses. Even if her blood had called toward Byrne Kells, not yet Big Kells in those days, although his father was dead, slain in the woods by a vert or some such nightmare, instead of Jack Ross, she wasn't sure she would have slipped the rope with him. Kells was good-humored and laughing when he was sober and as steady as sand through a glass, but he could be angry and quick with his fists when he was drunk. And he was drunk often in those days. His binges grew longer and more frequent after Ross and Nell were wed, and on many occasions he woke up in jail. Jack had borne it a while, but after a binge where Kells had destroyed most of the furniture in the saloon before passing out, Nell told her husband something had to be done. Big Ross reluctantly agreed. He got his partner and old friend out of jail, as he had many times before, but this time he spoke to him frankly, instead of just telling Kells to go jump in the creek and stay there until his head was clear. "Listen to me, Byrne, and with both ears. You've been my friend since I could toddle, and my pard since we were old enough to go past the Blossy and into the Ironwood on our own.
You've watched my back, and I've watched yours. There's not a man I trust more when you're sober. But once you pour the red eye down your throat, you're no more reliable than quick mud. I can't go into the forest alone, and everything I have, everything we both have, is at risk if I can't depend on thee. I'd hate to cast about for a new pard, but fair warning. I have a wife and a kitty on the way, and I'll do what I have to do. Kells continued his drinking, brawling, and bawding for a few more months, as if to spite his old friend and his old friend's new wife. Big Ross was on the verge of severing their partnership when the miracle happened. It was a small miracle, hardly more than 5 feet from toes to crown, and her name was Millicent Redhouse. What Byrne Kells would not do for Big Ross, he did for Millie. When she died in childbirth 6 seasons later, and the babby soon after, even before the flush of labor had faded from the poor woman's dead cheek, the midwife confided to Nell, Ross was gloomy. He'll go back to the drink now, and gods know what will become of him. But Big Kells stayed sober, and when his business happened to bring him into the vicinity of Giddy's saloon, he crossed to the other side of the street. He said it had been Millie's dying request, and to do otherwise would be an insult to her memory. I'll die before I take another drink, he said. He had kept this promise, but Nell sometimes felt his eyes upon her. Often, even. He had never touched her in a way that could be called intimate, or even forward, had never stolen so much as a riptide kiss, but she felt his eyes. Not as a man looks at a friend, or at a friend's wife, but as a man looks at a woman. Tim came home an hour before sunset, with hay stuck to every visible inch of his sweaty skin, but happy. Farmer Destry had paid him in scrip for the town store, a fairish sum, and his good wife had added a sack of her sweet peppers and bustard tomatoes. Nell took the scrip and the sack, thanked him, kissed him, gave him a well-stuffed popkin, and sent him down to the spring to bathe. Ahead of him, as he stood in the cold water, ran the dreaming, mist-banded fields toward the Inners and Gilead. To his left bulked the forest, which began less than a wheel away. In there, it was twilight even at noonday, his father had said. At the thought of his father, his happiness at being paid a man's wages, or almost, for a day's work, ran out of him like grain from a sack with a hole in it. This sorrow came often, but it always surprised him. He sat for a while on a big rock with his knees drawn up to his chest and his head cradled in his arms. To be taken by a dragon so close to the edge of the forest was unlikely and terribly unfair, but it had happened before. His father wasn't the first and wouldn't be the last. His mother's voice came floating to him over the fields, calling him to come in and have some real supper. Tim called cheerily back to her, then knelt on the rock to splash cold water on his eyes, which felt swollen, although he had shed no tears. He dressed quickly and trotted up the slope. His mother had lit the lamps, for the gloaming had come, and they cast long rectangles of light across her neat little garden. Tired but happy again, for boys turn like weathercocks, so they do, Tim hurried into the welcoming glow of home. When the meal was done and the few dishes ridded between them, Nell said, I'd talk to you mother to son, Tim, and a bit more. You're old enough to work a little now, and you'll soon be leaving your childhood behind, sooner than I'd like, and you deserve a say in what happens. Is it about the covenant man, Mama? In a way, but I think more than that. She came close to saying, I fear instead of I think. But why would she? There was a hard decision to be made, an important decision, but what was there to fear? She led the way into their sitting room, so cozy Big Ross had almost been able to touch the opposing walls when he stood in the middle with his arms outstretched. And there, as they sat before the cold hearth, for it was a warm, full-earth night, she told him all that had passed between Big Kells and herself. Tim listened with surprise and mounting unease. So, Nell said when she had finished, what does thee think? But before he could answer, perhaps she saw in his face the worry she felt in her own heart, she rushed on. He's a good man, and was more brother than mate to your da. I believe he cares for me and cares for thee. No, thought Tim, I'm just what comes in the same saddlebag. He never even looks at me. Unless I happen to be with Da, that is. Or with you. Mama, I don't know. The thought of Big Kells in the house, lying next to his mama in his Da's place, made him feel light in his stomach, as if his supper had not set well. In truth, it no longer was sitting well. He's quit the drink, she said. Now she seemed to be talking to herself instead of to him. Years ago, he could be wild as a youth, but your da tamed him. And Millicent, of course. Maybe, but neither of them is here anymore, Tim pointed out. And Ma, he hasn't found anyone yet to partner him on the ironwood. He goes a-cutting on his own, and that's dead risky. It's early days yet, she said. He'll find someone to partner up with, for he's strong and he knows where the good stands are. Your father showed him how to find them when they were both fresh to the work, and they have fine stakeouts near the place where the trail ends. Tim knew this was so, but was less sure Kells would find someone to partner with. He thought the other woodcutters kept clear of him. They seemed to do it without knowing they were doing it, the way a seasoned woodsman would detour around a poison-thorn bush, even if he only saw it from the corner of his eye. Maybe I'm only making that up, he thought. I don't know, he said again. A rope that's slipped in church can't be unslipped. Nell laughed nervously. Where in full earth did thee hear that? From you, Tim said. She smiled. Yar, perhaps thee did, for my mouth's hung in the middle and runs at both ends. We'll sleep on it and see clearer in the morning. But neither of them slept much. Tim lay wondering what it would be like to have Big Kells as a steppa. Would he be good to them? Would he take Tim into the forest with him to begin learning the woodsman's life? That would be fine, he thought, but would his mother want him going into the line of work that had killed her husband? Or would she want him to stay south of the endless forest? To be a farmer? I like Destry well enough, he thought. But I'd never in life be a farmer, not with the endless forest so close and so much of the world to see. Nell lay a wall away with her own uncomfortable thoughts. Mostly she wondered what their lives would be like if she refused Kells's offer and they were turned out on the land, away from the only place they'd ever known. What their lives would be like if the Barony Covenanter rode up on his tall black horse, and they had nothing to give him. The next day was even hotter, but Big Kells came wearing the same broadcloth coat. His face was red and shining. Nell told herself she didn't smell graff on his breath. And if she did, what of it? 'Twas only hard cider, and any man might take a drink or two before going to hear a woman's decision. Besides, her mind was made up, or almost. Before he could ask his question, she spoke boldly, as boldly as she was able, anyhow. My boy reminds me that a rope slipped in church can't be unslipped. Big Kells frowned, although whether it was the mention of the boy or the marriage loop that fashed him, she could not tell. Aye, and what of that? Only, will you be good to Tim and me?
Aye, good as I can be.
His frown deepened. She couldn't tell if it was anger or puzzlement. She hoped for puzzlement. Men who could cut and chop and dare beasts in the deep wood often found themselves lost in affairs like this, she knew, and at the thought of Big Kells lost, her heart opened to him. "Set your word on it?" she asked. The frown eased. White flashed in his neatly trimmed black beard as he smiled.
Aye, by watch and by warrant.
Then, I say yes. and so they were wed. That is where many stories end. It's where this one, sad to say, really begins. There was Graff at the wedding reception, and for a man who no longer drank spirits, Big Kells tossed a goodly amount down his gullet. Tim viewed this with unease, but his mother appeared not to notice. Another thing that made Tim uneasy was how few of the other woodsmen showed up, although it was Eth Day. If he had been a girl instead of a boy, he might have noticed something else. Several of the women, whom Nell counted among her friends, were looking at her with expressions of guarded pity. That night, long after midnight, he was awakened by a thump and a cry that might have been part of a dream, but it seemed to come through the wall from the room his mother now shared, true but not yet possible to believe, with Big Kells. Tim lay listening, and had almost dropped off to sleep again when he heard quiet weeping. This was followed by the voice of his new steppa, low and gruff.
"Shut it, can't you? You ain't a bit hurt. There's no blood, and I have to be up with the birdies."
The sounds of crying stopped. Tim listened, but there was no more talk. Shortly after Big Kells' snores began, he fell asleep. The next morning, while she was at the stove frying eggs, Tim saw a bruise on his mother's arm above the inside of her elbow. "It's nothing," Nell said when she saw him looking. "I had to get up in the night to do the necessary and bumped it on the bedpost. I'll have to get used to finding my way in the dark again now that I'm not alone." Tim thought,
"Yar, that's what I'm afraid of."
When the second Eth Day of his married life came round, Big Kells took Tim with him to the house that now belonged to Baldy Anderson, Tree's other big farmer. They went in Kells's wood wagon. The mule stepped lightly with no rounds or strakes of ironwood to haul. Today there were only a few little piles of sawdust in the back of the wagon. And that lingering, sweet-sour smell, of course, the smell of the deep woods. Kells's old place looked sad and abandoned with its shutters closed and the tall, unscythed grass growing up to the splintery porch slats.
"Once I get my gunna out in it, let Baldy take it all for kindling, do it please him," Kells grunted. "Fine with me."
As it turned out, there were only two things he wanted from the house, a dirty old footrest and a large leather trunk with straps and a brass lock. This was in the bedroom, and Kells stroked it as if it were a pet.
"Can't leave this," he said. "Never this. 'Twas my father's."
Tim helped him get it outside, but Kells had to do most of the work. The trunk was very heavy. When it was in the wagon bed, Big Kells leaned over with his hands on the knees of his newly and neatly mended trousers. At last, when the purple patches began to fade from his cheeks, he stroked the trunk again, and with a gentleness Tim had as yet not seen applied to his mother.
"All I own stowed in one trunk. As for the house, did Baldy pay the price I should have had?"
He looked at Tim challengingly, as if expecting an argument on this subject.
"I don't know," Tim said cautiously. "Folks say Cy Anderson's close."
Kells laughed harshly.
"Close? Close? Tight as a virgin's coochie is what he is. Nar, nar. I got crumbs instead of a slice, for he knew I couldn't afford to wait. Help me tie up this tailboard, boy, and be not sluggardly."
Tim was not sluggardly. He had his side of the tailboard roped tight before Kells had finished tying his in a sloppy ollie knot that would have made his father laugh. When he was finally done, Big Kells gave his trunk another of those queerly affectionate caresses.
"All in here now. All I have. Old Baldy knew I had to have silver before wide earth, didn't he? Old you-know-who is coming, and he'll have his hand out."
He spat between his old scuffed boots.
"This is all your ma's fault."
"Ma's fault? Why? Didn't you want to marry her?"
"Watch your mouth, boy."
Kells looked down, seemed surprised to see a fist where his hand had been, and opened his fingers. You're too young to understand. When you're older, you'll find out how women can get the good of a man. Let's go on back. Halfway to the driving seat, he stopped and looked across the stowed trunk at the boy. I love your ma, and that's enough for you to be going on with. And as the mules trotted up the village high street, Big Kel sighed and added, I loved your da, too. And how I miss him. 'Tain't the same without him beside me in the woods, or seeing Misty and Bitsy up the trail ahead of me. At this, Tim's heart opened a little to the big, slump-shouldered man with the reins in his hands, in spite of himself, really. But before the feeling had any chance to grow, Big Kel spoke again. You've had enough of books and numbers and that weirdy smack woman. She with her veils and shakes, how she manages to wipe her arse after she shits is more than I'll ever know. Tim's heart seemed to clap shut in his chest. He loved learning things, and he loved the widow smack, veil, shakes, and all. It dismayed him to hear her spoken of with such crude cruelty. What would I do then? Go into the woods with you? He could see himself on Da's wagon, behind Misty and Bitsy. That would not be so bad. No, not so bad at all. Kells barked a laugh. You, in the woods, and not yet 12? I'll be 12 next month. You won't be big enough to lumber on the Ironwood Trail at twice that age, for you take after your ma's side of things and will be small Ross all your life. That bark of laughter again. Tim felt his face grow hot at the sound of it. No, lad, I've spoken a place for you at the sawmill. You ain't too small to stack boards. You'll start after harvest done and before first snow. What does Mama say? Tim tried to keep the dismay out of his voice and failed. She don't get I, no, or maybe in the matter. I'm her husband, and that makes me the one to decide. He snapped the reins across the backs of the plodding mules. Hop! Tim went down to Tree Sawmill 3 days later with one of the Destry boys, Straw Willem, so called for his nearly colorless hair. Both were hired on to stack, but they would not be needed for yet a while, and only part-time, at least to begin with. Tim had brought his father's mules, which needed the exercise, and the boys rode back side by side.
"Thought you said your new step-papa didn't drink," Willem said as they passed Giddy's, which at midday was shuttered tight, its barrel-house piano silent.
"He doesn't," Tim said, but he remembered the wedding reception.
"Do you say so? I guess the fella my big brother seed rolling out of yonder red eye last night must have been some other orphing boy steppa, because Randy said he was as sloshed as a shindy bug and heaving up over the hitching rail."
Having said this, Willem snapped his suspenders, as he always did when he felt he'd gotten off a good one. Should have let you walk back to town, you stupid git, Tim thought. That night, his mother woke him again. Tim sat bolt upright in bed and swung his feet out onto the floor, then froze. Kells's voice was soft, but the wall between the two rooms was thin.
"Shut it, woman. If you wake the boy and get him in here, I'll give you double."
Her crying ceased.
"It was a slip, is all. A mistake. I went in with Mellon just to have a ginger beer and hear about his new steak, and someone put a glass of Jackaro in front of me. It was down my throat before I knew what I was drinking, and then I was off. 'Twon't happen again. You have my word on it."
Tim lay back down again, hoping that was true. He looked up at a ceiling he could not see, and listened to an owl, and waited for either sleep or the first light of morning. It seemed to him that if the wrong man stepped into the marriage loop with a woman, it was a noose instead of a ring. He prayed that wasn't the case here. He already knew he couldn't like his mother's new husband, let alone love him, but perhaps his mother could do both. Women were different. They had larger hearts.
Tim was still thinking these long thoughts as dawn tinted the sky, and he finally fell asleep.